Hello and welcome to the Dank Christian Memes podcast. My name is Brocklin. I'm one of the moderators for Dank Christian Memes, along with Jacob here. I'm also the digital minister and the host for this here podcast. I'm joined by Caster Troy, and as I said, Jacob. You guys want to say a quick hi? Let the people know you're here of your own will and you're not being kept by force.
This is mostly true. It only took seeing the hot iron this time and not applying it. My name's Jacob, and I am one of the regular co-hosts here. I have a background in archaeology, and I enjoy chatting here.
My name's Caster Troy, as you can see. And yes, I am also here of my own free will and volition. Brocklin has not sent the goons to come and get me. I talk about pop culture stuff, and sometimes people pay me for it. This is not one of those signs. This is done my own, again, free will and just out of the kindness of my heart to my buddy.
No one's getting paid for anything, just to make sure everyone's clear.
Well, the hosting service, once you convert this to a podcast, is getting paid.
That's true. So it's costing us money, though. We are not getting paid for this. So before we jump in, I just wanted to talk a little bit about like my first kind of introduction to sort of masculinity as a concept. So I went to a congregational church. I don't know if anyone watches The Simpsons, but like in The Simpsons family, Marge is the one who kind of like pushes the family to get out the door and to get to church because, you know, we should try to better ourselves, at least in principle. And that was sort of a similar concept in my community. It was clear that, you know, many of the women, many of the mothers, they were the movers and shakers in the church to a large degree. So there was a men's group. Which, you know, I'll be curious to know if either of you guys, if you have church experience, if they had a men's group. And I'm not really sure to this day what a men's group would do, but I know this one, and I participated in this, we would do communion, or Eucharist, as some folks might call it, on the first Sunday of every month, which means we didn't do it on the other Sundays. So we saw a significant drop off on that first Sunday to the second Sunday. So they started what they call the second Sunday brunches, where all the dads, many of which don't come to worship anyway, cooked dinner in the church basement. And then at the end of church, everyone had a brunch and, you know, they could donate to help offset the costs, but it was just sort of a cool way to engage with the community. And it, you know, gave the dads and sons, a couple of the daughters, a way to engage. So that was really cool and, you know, flips things on its head. You know, moms, at least in this time, I think were expected to be doing a lot of the cooking in this particular context. So having dads do that was a little bit of a role reversal. But that was just like my first introduction to masculinity as like a concept. Caster Troy, I don't know if you even came from a religious background, but what would you say was your first kind of like acknowledgement that like masculinity is a concept, or is that just something you always knew and I was slow on the pickup here?
So first, no, I didn't come from a especially religious background. Like I do come from a Black family that's originally frenzy from the South. So yes, there are religious roots there, but it was one of those things that once our great migration happened, it was that next generation. They were like, hey, either you go to church or you don't, we're really not going to force you to do it. So I was in and out. And then once I turned like 12, I was like, you know what? I think I'm just going to make the firm out. Like I'm good. I want my weekends to myself situation. So my versions of masculinity didn't really come from that prism. What mine came from really, when I was coming up, the older men specifically, the younger men, they had their own tiptoes and trying to figure this out. But the older men specifically would call out things that they deemed not masculine or specifically feminine that they saw young boys doing. There was never a notion of enforcing femininity on younger girls because that kind of just happened by accident. I think we might get into that as we talk, where how young girls are typically given like, oh, you play with this doll. Also, this thing that you use as a toy is a kitchen set that teaches you the roles of the modern wife and it teaches you how to cook and clean and all that sort of stuff. Whereas younger boys, if you dipped into that, like, let's say, oh, I want to play with my cousin's kitchen set. They're like, no, go play with the truck. no, let's go outside and play basketball. That's what men do. That's what boys do. So that was the framing of masculinity. And then as you get older, you start to pick from different examples of what being a man looks like. That's how I saw it.
So there was a do and a don't before necessarily the sort of models that we see in media were, you know, something that was playing a role.
Exactly. But you'd also get little cues where you, like I said, again, you're interacting with whether it's your dad or your uncles or friends, like anybody that was older that you were using as the example. Let's say you're watching a movie. Sometimes they let something slip out like, yeah, that's how a man acts. And we're watching like Lethal Weapon or something like that. And it's like, oh, I don't think Riggs is supposed to be a positive masculine male role model. But sure, all right, I guess that's what men do. So there was.
And I definitely want to hit that, the what I call the not a role model concept. Yeah. I have a couple, I have a few pre-prepared, and then like I'm happy to you know, kind of see where we twist and turn here. Jacob, did you have any kind of men's group in your church, or did you come from a church that was a men's group, as I think maybe a lot of them are?
it existed and I never went. I did go to youth group though, but that was mixed. I think the idea of a men's group when I was young did not feel that relevant to me, simply because I was young when the idea occurred. And, you know, youth groups aren't typically that gender separated, at least in the evangelical background that I grew up in, right?
Yeah, I always thought that was kind of the appeal of youth groups, is that they were, you know, co-ed.
Yeah, and so... By the time that the, you know, the men's group became relevant to me as a concept, I was kind of a little bit out of the like traditional macho husband paradigm that like it looks like from the outside, if that makes sense.
So from the outside, it looked like a pretty restrictive model.
It looks like a type of manliness that I don't see myself in, and so it hasn't had a draw. Not that it's a bad place; it would be good if I went. But like, you know, it's
well. I want to keep that in mind. That
magnetism, yeah.
As we go forward, like, what, you know, what do you see yourself in, and what do you not, maybe, and perhaps why? So I want to acknowledge that, you know, I think a lot of things we're going to talk about probably have their partner subject on the discussion about femininity. So I'm going to start with one of my models, and then I'll throw it out there, and you know, we can come back to some of my prepared ones if no one else has anything they want to throw out. But the first one I wanted to start with was the Marlboro Man, and I'm pretty old, so I'm old enough to remember when like cigarettes were allowed to advertise in earnest.
Actually advertised and had mascots in that.
And they had mascots that were like more than a little trying to appeal to younger kids and adults. But what I think is interesting about the Marlboro Man is I believe I'm going over the wiki page here, trying to make sure I don't get anything wrong here, but he was used from 1954 to 1999. And by the time I saw him, he was basically a cowboy in Montana or something, who was always smoking, obviously, because that's what he's designed to do, to sell cigarettes. But what I didn't realize is that the company had an issue where they had sold cigarettes with filters as a more feminine solution, so that, you know, I think in some circles, smoking for women was not really as okay a thing. So I think they introduced filters as a way to sort of bridge that gap. And they used the slogan, mild as May. So then they wanted to market filtered cigarettes to men, but they had already enforced how feminine it was. So they invented the Marlboro Man, which had a few different forms. But like I said, he was mostly a guy on a horse with always a cigarette in his mouth. And I think I grew up around plenty of smokers. And I think I always felt like, for this reason, that, you know, models of masculinity are trying to sell me something, potentially something literally toxic. So I think the Marlboro Man has made me very critical of anything that isn't, you know, the little men's Sunday brunch that I grew up with.
No, go ahead,
Jacob. Sorry. I was going to say, I think there's... a comparison to be drawn here in that the Marlboro Man's aesthetic, the like gritty cowboy aesthetic, is so pervasive that it's a useful signal. For example, you've probably seen the boomer memes where it's like, what's the guy in the opening of Big Lebowski?
Sam Elliott.
Yeah, Sam Elliott, where he's always like this emblem of supposedly what the old school man's man is like. And it's just him in that specific costume, but the signaling, the little symbols used, the cowboy hat, the like blue collar clothing.
It's a shorthand.
Right. It's an imagery shorthand for a supposed model for masculinity. It in fact represents one specific type of it, which is a fine type. But you can see it all the time in memes where the intended purpose is to juxtapose the supposed toughness with, you know, whatever he's criticizing in the text. And that just goes to show how powerful a lot of these advertising tropes are. I'm not going to say advertising started it, because obviously cowboy novels are a very old genre in American literature. You know, they've probably perpetuated this into an age where it exists as a shorthand visual for photographic media, right?
Yeah, I think it's definitely got some meme-like value to it. We have a comment where someone said, is it safe to say that modern portrayal of masculinity has shifted in the last 50 years? I think that the Marlboro Man is a perfect picture of that. And then, you know, he disappeared because now it's illegal to advertise cigarettes, I think at all, but certainly in that way, that he started as something different, but he did become a cowboy. And then I think he kind of went from a gritty cowboy to a pretty cowboy as he approached the end of his time in the 90s. I think that, you know, we had a smoother, cleaner cut Marlboro Man, and probably some closer up, higher resolution images of him looking younger, I think, as well. I obviously, I don't have all the pictures in front of me. This is just me going through Wikipedia and my memory of the advertising campaign.
Step further than you went a little bit earlier and say that almost all depictions of masculinity that you see anywhere are actively trying to sell you something. And I'll even go back to what you were both and Jacob were both saying. Notice how the shorthand of the specifically American cowboy, the American West, is constantly used to kind of figure that part out. So what you'll see is you spoke of the Marlboro Man. They were, when they switched to the cowboy, the frontiersman side of that, you specifically saw them advertising that to city folk that were moving out from the cities and out from those areas that needed cowboys, that needed farmers. People weren't farming and tending to their fields. And there was this kind of, wasn't a backlash, but there was a response to making men feel like men in fields where they didn't look and act like their dads did. We still get that today. You still get a lot of that today, and we will get to it. But the Marlboro Man picked up an accent because, like, hey, I know you're working in the city and you're working with that briefcase and you're wearing suits and you just want to relax, just like the frontiersmen did. And they showed the cowboys rolling up their cigarettes and figuring it out. And that pervaded and that worked for a long time. But that was a specific response to, as you said, they had advertised cigarettes specifically to women with filters and things like that. But also keep in mind, cigarettes as a whole were advertised to women as a compliment to cigars. Men smoked cigars, women smoked cigarettes. That's why they're called that. And that's why once they shot themselves in the foot with that depiction, they leaned hard on the Marlboro Man. But even like the brawny big paper towel man was a frontiersman that was chopping wood. There's no reason there's a big lumberjack dude that was on the front of your paper towels. That just worked, that they like that appeal. So there's a lot of things that are raw masculinity that are used in advertising to make it seem like, oh no, dudes can do this too. Specifically, and I'm going to fast forward 70 years in advertising, that's why dude wipes exist. Like, that's literally the purpose for the brand of dude wipes. Men can wipe their butts with moist towelettes. That's what they're selling you.
It has been decided.
To take the other side of this advertising thing and bring up the the outrage media of a few years ago. Remember that Gillette ad that there was like a big buzz on the internet about?
I have to say the first Gillette Mach 3 ad like took me in hook, line, and sinker, and I still use that razor. So, you know, I do have a level of susceptibility to this stuff too.
I mean, I'm specifically referring to the one that was about like men should be the best they can be sort of thing. I don't remember exactly how it worded it.
Sounds like an army commercial, but okay.
It was an ad that presumably on its face asked men to be less toxic and to essentially try to be quote unquote real men, which was
I saw a little news piece on it. Yeah.
And there was a certain amount of outrage because this sort of thing always activates certain people on the internet. But when you look at it on its face, it's the same tactic as the Marlboro Man, but switched in that it portrays a message about what masculinity is and tries to sell a product by saying, look, you can be a cool, better man, but it's aiming at a slightly different mindset. And so I think this relationship between masculinity and advertising goes multiple directions in that the shifting discussion about what it is to be a man directs what is profitable advertising. At the same time, these ads portray a specific type of masculinity out there, right?
Well, I feel like there's, and again, maybe I'm just betraying the time when I grew up, but I feel like there was an understanding that, yes, women are especially targeted by these following products on a regular basis through advertising and, you know, product placements and so forth. So I feel like now men are a little more aware that is happening to them as well. But I think there's also some issues with brand loyalty. So I want to take us a little bit out of the advertising space, but let's not go too far. I want to compare the Marlboro Man to the Mandalorian, because I think that the Mandalorian is sort of like a spaghetti Western in some ways. And I think that sort of like the Marlboro Man, there's some shorthand. He's a stoic, especially early on, a stoic fighter who never shows his face. Am I imagining things, or are these things like sort of iterations of each other?
No, I have not seen the Mandalorian.
You're not imagining it, but you're also picking up on a trend very much of older millennial, younger Gen Xer media. Like now that we are of the age to actually create the media that's going out in mass, there is very much, and I'm saying this while I'm looking at a poster that I got from Logan Noir, the Wolverine movie Logan. I have that right in front of me as I'm saying this. There was a not so subtle but almost accidental zeitgeist of men realizing they didn't have relationships with their fathers they wanted, and now they're creating media where the surrogate father is the thing. The Mandalorian, we're getting that with The Last of Us, the game and the movie. We got it with Logan.
And that's something I wanted to bring up, that I feel like for some things more than others, that there's a high level of what I would call vicarity, that you know, I am invested in. I don't know if people were invested in the Marlboro Man, but you know, I think there's plenty of people who see Mandalorians and say, yeah. I would say, I think what's interesting about Mandalorians is how they frequently tell each other that they're not actually Mandalorians or not proper Mandalorians in some way. And that just reminds me of different religious groups commenting on dead Christian memes sometimes. But I also, you know, enjoy how the character becomes more nuanced and maybe less of a archetype or a stock character maybe.
Oh no, that's what I was getting to. That's baked into it. Another big one I was just forgetting because it's not a surrogate, but it's a similar thing. The new God of War, God of War games. It's very much
even call it Dad of War.
Yeah, and it's all based around the father figure is the stoic, very much the archetype of old school masculinity. Like they don't show their emotions much, and if they do, it's usually anger. It's usually very much, we got to do it this way, and you're slowly watching that figure become more of a full figured man, including all versions of masculinity, and not just external, like I chop wood, I do this. Like, no, I can be nurturing. I can be this. That's part of what masculinity is. And that's a huge part of what modern media is in representations of masculinity, because it's a bunch of guys who grew up with their dads being the stoic ones, and they probably never broke down that wall. They never got that full connection later. And now they're writing stories as they are becoming fathers and going, oh, this is the type of father I want to be, but this is the father example that I got. This is the masculine example that I got. And you're watching all these stories come out that are showing that. And it's a whole bunch of 40 something year old men realize, like, oh man, being a dad's kind of tough. I should have been easier on my father, but he had some stuff he had to work on. And you're watching that come through in the art and what that means for masculinity. There's like, it's not by accident. It's purely a bunch of people reacting to the same thing at the exact same time, because it's all, they're all the same age. And we're all watching it going, yep, that makes sense. And you were crying as the Mandalorian takes his mask off and picks up Baby Yoda and talks to him. And we're watching as Joel figures it out with Ellie. We're watching Kratos yell boy a little bit softly as the game ends. He's like, no, you're right, boy, I'm gonna follow your lead. Like, it's all little things like that, and I just love watching it happen as people are all surprised by it. And I was like, no, this is the flip. We, especially coming out of the 90s, where there was this weird divide in what masculinity was, because we were trying to soften everyone's image. Like, we all didn't have to be the ubermensch all the time. So that's where you got the guys can wear suits, and guys can not suits, but guys can wear like tailored and fashionable suits. It's not just suits to go to work. You can look good. You can put pride in your appearance. The whole metrosexual movement of the mid 90s was saying, yeah, you can take part in these less than masculine things as part of your masculinity. And now we've kind of, I don't want to say right of the ship, because it was never wrong, but like realize you don't have to go to super extremes to either to define masculinity. But yeah, we're like modern media right now at where it is has a very interesting look at old school masculinity bumping up against new school mentalities. Basically, a bunch of old school masculine people went to therapy and figured some stuff out.
So I have another one to bring up, but I don't want to monopolize. So if either of you guys have another, I'm calling them models of masculinity or examples or whatever, but I don't want to necessarily monopolize the conversation.
I guess I can go then. I've got an example from one of my favorite bad movies. If you guys have seen 300, right?
Oh, yes. Yep.
Yeah, so 300.
Not recently, but definitely.
300 is one of my favorite guilty watches. It is horrendously historically inaccurate. It bears like no resemblance to the actual historical events it portrays at all. And it has like, fascistic overtones. But it portrays a very staunch version of masculinity that I think, it just like rests in your mind once you see it, because essentially it plays into the long-standing tradition of fetishizing the Spartans as like the model male warrior. And it specifically puts it in a context where they're the defenders of the West. And this idea is that like buff masculine men who are willing to do their civic duty to the
exceptionally
state.
Buff, like yeah. Always perpetually naked, always glistening, like, even in the dark of night somehow. Right, it is a preposterous like Adonis of men that they present.
Never wear armor. Like if you have
why wouldn't you wear armor?
I don't know. You'd think that they might be able to hold out a little longer if they also, if they had those like several thousand allies that Herodotus says were there, but essentially, the like version of masculinity that 300 portrays is like a very ideological one, which is set within the context of an idea of civic duty, right? So,
for the glory of Sparta, I guess.
For the glory of Sparta, but as an empathetic thing for the audience, for the glory of Western civilization, right? Like they are, it's not stated because, of course, putting the idea of Western civilization in the minds of ancient Greeks would be absurd. They just saw everyone who wasn't Greek as a barbarian.
That's a bit of an anachronism, is it not?
Yeah. So, you know, they don't express this, but they do express this, like, idea that this legacy will go on, that they're protecting, you know, they name drop democratic Athens as something they're protecting, which we know historically Sparta would, like, overthrow a few decades later in the Peloponnesian War. But, you know, so it projects this idea. There's not just masculinity, as we've discussed, which is like duties in the home, like within the household structure. There's also this idea in media of it as duties within society to the state, the soldier, the like defender of tradition, the strong man who protects when lifeways are under threat. That's another thing that is very pervasive in a lot of media, and which, you know, I don't think it's talked about as much because civic duty is still something that most people believe in, regardless of their stance on gender roles, right? To some extent, this idea that you have a duty to the society you live in.
We live in a society.
But the thing is, this is highly associated with masculinity historically, and they're drawing off a real however bastardized, they're drawing off a real phenomenon in ancient Greece, which is the idea of the warrior citizen, the fact that in Sparta, and actually in Athens too, which was basically a military junta by today's standards, the role of the citizen was partly to fight, and this has a long-standing
Like, that's very appealing to the American cowboy John Wayne.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's the same genre. And you want to expand it
something really quickly before we leave 300. Two things, actually. One, because I was going to use Zack Snyder as a version of modern masculinity in media, or masculinity in media, period. So I'm glad you used 300. But two, let's not forget, because you both kind of touched on it, we have to remember that 300 movie in canon, in what the movie's representing, is literally a propaganda piece. The reason everything is so historically inaccurate, the reason everything is so bombastic, the reason it is what it literally what it is because it's the Spartans telling the story. Remember, it bookends with the character that Leonidas sends back, like, hey, go tell everybody what's happening. And he's telling the Spartan version, like, yeah, we look like this in the moonlight, and we did this, and we so that's why it looks that way. It's by design. But the part of it that's not quite by design that touches on the masculinity thing that you're talking about is, remember the scene when the Apollonians and the other citizens are trying to, like, hey, Leonidas, we're going to help you out. What can we do? And Leonidas, we don't need you guys. And they're like, why not? And he goes, well, what do you do? Like, oh, I'm a farmer. I'm a this, I'm a that. And he goes, Spartans, what do we do? And they do that war cry. They're actually negating the fact that civic duty is a masculine thing because they only see it as combat. They don't see it as all the other things that masculinity can provide. We still need farmers. We still need accountants. We still need all these things that aren't specifically combat. But they're like, no, Spartans, we fight. That's it. That's all.
But where are your glistening abs? How are you going to fight without glistening abs?
You don't look like us. How are you masculine? And that, so that's always funny to me. But that's Zack Snyder for you. And that's why I was going to bring up Zack Snyder. He has a very, and this goes into a different thing, he has a very Ayn Randian outlook on just his art. I don't want to say his life, but specifically his art. It's all very much gods amongst men, the special don't owe society anything. It's all by choice. So watching him bump up against Spartan, Spartan lore in history was interesting because it was very much a hodgepodge of his ideology smacking against each other. But if you watch his version of Superman, it's very much a hyper-masculine version of Superman. Like, Superman just couldn't be in shape. He got Henry Cavill into the most ridiculous shape a man could be in. He did the same thing with Batman. When you're watching Batman versus Superman, you're supposed to be watching a withered older version of Batman go up against Superman. But he's still doing CrossFit and like he's bursting out of every suit he wears because they made Ben Affleck get massively huge. And Ben Affleck's already a big, muscular looking dude. He did the same thing with Watchmen, where, yes, Dr. Manhattan was supposed to be an idyllic, a intellectually idyllic person who's also just crumbled by the fact that he knew too much. But still, we have to make him look like literally a Greek god, much like he made.
Is there a reason he couldn't wear pants? I mean, I don't mean to seem like a prude here, but like, I mean, he did not believe in pants once he became like an ascended being.
The funny thing is, in the comics, they address that, and they still make him wear pants, like the little pantaloons, occasionally because he realized it was upsetting for people. And Zack Snyder was like, "No, nah, I'm going to keep him naked more times than he needs to be." It didn't bother me as much, but I know you've been harping on that one for the 13 years of that movie's been out, or longer now. Oh man, but yeah, Zack Snyder is a version of someone who sees masculinity a very specific way, and that's how he portrays it in media. So that was going to be my example of just like how people can get the visual aesthetic of masculinity and try to work that into some sort of meta narrative or subtext. And then it just becomes the text because they're not really good at writing the subtext of what their masculinity is. Another example, and I believe, Broccoli, you wanted me to kind of talk on this a bit, is professional wrestling. And if you look at
absolutely, yes,
wrestling, I'm going to start specifically in the 80s, because I'm going to go with the Rock and wrestling era that most people kind of know, like the jumping off point of the Macho Mans and the Hulk Hogan's. But if you go just a few decades before that, the reaction to what masculinity was often used to get heat, to get negative reactions. So you'd have these big, burly, manly men, because they're wrestling in smoky arenas throughout the Northeast and the South. And a good heel, a good bad guy, was somebody that poked fun at masculinity. So you get people like Gorgeous George or Freddie Blassie, who comes out in like a feather boa and plays up some homoeroticism and some feminine side. And that was immediate, like, you get booze for that. Regardless of what your character was, if you acted like something that was anti-masculine, you got booze. And then so you fast forward to the 80s, where you get a little bit more flamboyancy, but that's still played up for booze and negativity.
Wasn't androgyny sort of a trend in the 80s in some fashion circles?
Androgyny especially became a trend in the late 70s, mid 80s. I mean, you talk about the Bowies and like the Grace Joneses and things like that. But specifically in wrestling, androgyny has always been used, even back to its vaudevillian days to now. But the version you get of it now, and I'm going to just hit a couple key timelines. So you fast forward, you get a little bit of androgyny in the 80s, and then you really get it in the 90s with the characters like Goldust, who are playing up like on all of the toxic masculinity, like freaking men out. Cause like, is this guy gay? Is this guy straight? What's he going to do? Why is he dressing like a girl? Why is he acting like that? That's still there.
I'm no expert on wrestling, but the first time I saw Goldust, I was like, what's happening right now? I'm just confused.
Design, but it's specifically tapping into that. That's not a man's thing, but he's still getting in the ring to fight. So like, but that's a man. It's all operating on that level. You fast forward to now, and there's a character within, I'm going just to WWE, the larger company. Seth Rollins, who's one of the top guys in the company, he started this character, I want to say about 2 or 3 years ago, where he's basically like a super, like his nickname was like the drip guy. Like he wears like flamboyant outfits, wearing suits, all sorts of things. When that character started, it started as a heel because it was playing up that like, oh, you're the douchey androgynous guy that nobody likes. The problem with that is people also kind of really like Seth Rollins. So he plays into it more. He dials down some of the flamboyance and some of the androgyny to play up more of the masculine side, like he can still beat people up. But you can see when he's working heel or face, bad guy or good guy, based on how much he's egging on the quote unquote perceived masculinity of the crowd by how much he plays into the non-masculine parts of it. And it's very interesting to watch that play out in wrestling, because for all of it being physical combat, uber masculine on surface, it's all still pageantry. It's still a bunch of people getting in tights and doing stage choreographed fights and things like that, which are decidedly not masculine in the broader sense, but they're using it to present this very masculine package. So it's always been that wrestling's flirtation and dance with masculinity has always been interesting to me because of how much it isn't just in the machinations that make it work, but they're using it to show something that's supposed to be masculine.
So I want to take a quick pause and note that if anyone is raising their hands, I can't see that. So I don't know if anyone actually is raising their hands, but I'm not seeing that. I am seeing a few comments, like someone thinks that Caster Troy sounds like Kratos. I think that's a compliment. What do you think, Troy?
Well, I'll take it. I will absolutely take it.
I wonder if it meant that your Kratos impression was particularly spot on.
I only said boy, so if that's all I got to do is just say boy a little bit, I can pull that one off, but I cannot pull that. I get lightheaded if I try to talk like Kratos for too long. That man has a deep register.
Yes, he definitely does. So in the world of WWE, like, is that sort of the theme? different models or kinds of masculinity being slammed against each other for your entertainment?
I mean,
yeah. And also divas?
Yes, and that's, if we want to talk especially with how they're, I mean, well, we'll call out, they don't call them divas anymore. They've made that
Oh my goodness. I am so sorry. I'm so ignorant.
But it does show that they have responded to lists. Like, oh yeah, people don't want that anymore. They've gotten much better about that. I won't say much. They've just gotten better. But yeah, it's always been, and if you watch, because it's, wrestling is very much a lowest common denominator type of show, and I'm not saying that to denigrate anyone. I'm a huge wrestling fan, but because of just its roots of carny vaudeville stuff, it's like, hey, we have to make sure the audience understands what's happening. So it's always going to be big, bombastic, easy to recognize character types for the most part, and then you kind of whittle down. And so I'm again going just rewinding back to the 90s. Because people make fun of that, because it was literally just occupations. The plumber is going to fight the dentist. The IRS guy is going to fight the nightclub bouncer. It's like these big, easy to identify archetypes that are usually some form of the masculine versions of it.
Well, and we had things like Shawn Michaels, who is not so subtly at all wearing crosses and pointing to Christian imagery in a way that, you know, checks a box for a lot of, you know, Christian viewers who are like, yes, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Yeah. And who I say, no one takes a beating like Shawn Michaels. He does a really good job of being the crucified Lord in his wrestling matches to the extent that you can do that.
Well, he also, and, Shawn Michaels in his born again era, you always had a fascinating relationship with that, but you have to remember.
He was shooting across the bow right at me. How can I not have a reaction at it?
No, and that's the intent. But you got to keep in mind, before he was the born again version of himself, which obviously drew in his real life when he did realize, like, hey, I kind of want to get away from some of this. He was the sex machine. He was in Playgirl. Like, he was very much like doing the sin.
DX too, right?
DX, all of that. But with that, keep in mind what we were talking about before. He was thumbing his nose in certain versions of masculinity. He was the hypersexualized masculine guy. Like, I'm coming out, I'm going to steal your girl, and I'm going to dance provocatively. That makes you uncomfortable because men aren't supposed to dance or ride around. Like, he was a Chippendales dancer, essentially. And that was rubbing up against masculinity, but he still kicked somebody's ass. Like, and that's what made, that's again, that is wrestling. And that was, again, through the 90s prism when everything was turned up to 11 and 12, because we're talking about the Jerry Springer area where everything had to be a little bit salacious and all that. But it was still to its roots. Big burly guy fighting big burly guy. How do we make you care about either of these big burly guys? We need you to hate this one. We need you to like this one. Well, this one, and I'm going to talk about like guys like Lex Luger or Diesel. Like, he's the classic sense of masculinity. Works out, says his prayers, eats his vitamins, looks great, doesn't ride around. And then there's the Shawn Michaels guy who super sexy, posing for a girl. He's bringing Pamela Anderson to award shows, stuff like that. And it's going to make you jealous, but also want to be him. Like, it was all sorts of things woven into one. And you still get that today. They do try to play it a little bit for more subtle nuance because it is 2023 and that's how media works. But it's still wrestling and they have to like, well, we got to make this as obvious as possible. So who's the good guy, big masculine guy? Brock Lesnar. Why? Because he works out on the farm, hates everybody, but he can beat everybody up. Well, who's the good guy? This little flippy dude who wears nice shorts and says nice things to people. Still very different versions of masculinity that we can pit up against each other. And oh man, wrestling is very fascinating in that way because it's trying to reach all things to all people in a very specific way.
Well, if we're ready to move away from wrestling, I have one, but I don't want to, you know, don't want to dominate. Jacob, did you want to bring anything forward?
I do see a hand. We got a kooky. I don't know if you can see it, but kooky user.
I do see that hand, which suggests that I should see any other hands if they exist.
I do have an idea. Do we want to take the hand first? Oh, there we go.
Kooky use. Do you have a example or model of masculinity for us to consider and think about? Pretty stoic. Oh.
Hello.
Hi there. Did you have an example for us to talk about?
Wait, what are we talking about?
We are talking about models of masculinity, particularly in media. We've talked a little bit about advertising is where we started out. I think we've talked about wrestling. What else did we miss?
almost as far as we got, because I was going to go into action movies in general, but I want to give other people some time to, you know.
Oh, I was going to go into the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So we had some very different directions.
All right. Well, let's do Rocky Horror, and then I'll do mine, because I think it moves us in a movie's direction with a little twist.
All right. So basically, if you're not familiar with the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the premise of the movie is that, or rather the background to the movie is that in the 1970s, there was a time of blossoming gay media for the first time, essentially in Hollywood to a large scale. And this musical was created on a spectacularly low budget, with incredibly aggressively breaking gender norms and whatnot. So the premise of the movie is that, well, it's several things, but one of the major subplots is that the sort of secondary protagonist, Dr. Frankenfurter, who's like a mad scientist and a transvestite, creates in a lab for himself a manly man by the name of Rocky Horror in order to be like infatuated.
Played by Meatloaf? Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, if you've never seen the movie, it is incredibly, no, Meatloaf plays a different character. I'm looking at the list right now.
Thank you. Sorry.
But, so you have this idea of the manly man, which is Rocky Horror, the creation himself. But in this role, he is the sort of infatuation / creation of the subversion of what the manly man is supposed to be, which is Dr. Frankenfurter. And there's this interesting idea that like whatever you think about this dynamic, because Rocky spends much of the time running from him, there's this sort of juxtaposition of how manliness exists in a traditional sense in a world where it is actively subverted. It's not Dr. Frankenfurter who gets with Rocky Horror. It's one of the major female characters whose name I'm forgetting, Janet, who's the fiance of a different character who ends up getting together with him. And so you end up having a setup for a homosexual relationship that ends up being a heterosexual one. Because ultimately Rocky is playing the traditional masculine part, right? So there's a subversion within a subversion here. And I think that is just fascinating. It's like a thing to dive into.
Well, and Troy, maybe you could speak to this more, but I know that there's a cult following on Rocky Horror that has not really given up in any sense. And I suspect that they delight in that sort of dual subversion that you described there.
Well, the thing about Rocky, I mean, to say it has a cult following is underselling it massively. Rocky Horror is probably like the epitome of the cult movie, especially by modern standards. It's one of the ones that began the midnight screening of people interacting with the movie, throwing popcorn, reciting things like that. I'm hesitant to fully speak on Rocky Horror in this way, only because there's a huge queer element to Rocky Horror that I can't speak fully into. Like, I know a lot of queer people. I like the LGBT and their art influences, but I can't be like, yeah, this is exactly what this means, because I don't fully belong to the community. I will say, in terms of representation of masculinity in Rocky Horror, yeah, it's full of subversion on purpose. Like, the key points of that movie are, one, like, Dr. Frankenfurter is trans. Dr. Frankenfurter, I don't think, ever fully identifies as male or female, to the point where he hits on Janet and, crap, I never remember the fiance's name, but he gets in bed and tries to sleep with both of them. I think he actually succeeds in the case of
Janet. In nearly identical fashion, if I'm not mistaken. In the
exact same way for both of them. So Frankenfurter's just like, yeah, I'm just here to have sex with whoever's around. I'm trying to manipulate this relationship. Yes, Rocky is the male ideal that Frankenfurter creates, But like you already said, Jacob, Rocky is actively rejecting Dr. Frankenfurter. So there's a lot going on there. But just in terms of masculinity, even if you take Rocky out of it, so you have the super waspy fiance character played by Barry Boswick, who's very straight-laced. He's a version of masculinity that from Rocky IV was made in the 70s, but it's supposed to take place in the 50s. So it's them making fun of that version of masculinity. Then you have Rocky himself. There's literally a bronze mark, like Greek god that is created. Like that, there's a statue that Rocky was that it created man. That is one version of masculinity. The meatloaf character is another version of masculinity because it's the super biker greaser dude that comes through. So yeah, there's just a lot going on. Witty Connection has their hand raised. I think they want to hop in on the Rocky Horror side of things.
There we go.
So,
yeah, Witty, did you want to speak on Rocky Horror at all?
Yeah.
Niggas, shut up.
Of course. So, like,
anyway. I'm sorry.
It's like they got a child to do it too. Always interesting. But yeah, Rocky Horror is just showing so much stuff about masculinity and responding directly to it. But through the. Man, it's like a hat on a hat in a good way. It's taking place in the 50s, made in the 70s. So it's a lot of that responding to, like, hey, remember what they were trying to show us was real men and all that 20 years ago? Well, this is what real men are, but not actually showing what real men are. It's just messing with people's expectations of it. It's I find that endlessly interesting.
Jacob, did you want to say anything on Rocky Horror before we turn a corner?
To be honest, I did not have a conclusion. I just thought it was a very interesting example of how tropes can be subverted in a way that drives a plot. And I think it's a fascinating sort of counterexample to look at than a lot of the more traditional macho manly media we're referring to.
Yeah, Rocky Horror is definitely a standout, even among standouts. I was going to bring up again, and then we can veer into media, Stargate, because I feel like Stargate, both the original movie and the TV shows that kind of came afterwards, are two models of masculinity that have traditionally been held in sort of at odds, I guess, that we have the military Kurt Russell sort of tough guy, especially, you know, first Gulf War, that is. And then we have characters who are in the movie an archaeologist, but we have other kinds of scientists in the TV show, and that, you know, different kinds of masculinity and gasp than even women as we move in, like, have to actually work together, and that there's a sort of resentment around some of, you know, military people in the movies often, you know, start out by resenting these folks because they're civilians, so they're seen as, you know, someone to babysit, but you know, the way the plot moves forward is it really tries to take these two ideas and kind of not necessarily reconcile them, but like show the value of teamwork, even if you have different approaches. And I feel like Indiana Jones does that as well, but he's kind of like, it feels like when Indiana Jones is teaching class that he's playing a different character. Am I exaggerating that point too much?
Yeah, he's playing a realistic archaeologist as opposed to
he's pretending to be your professor, and you're supposed to pretend not to notice, I guess.
Well, yeah, I can't remember which Indiana Jones it's in. I think it's Last Crusade, where he specifically calls out like archaeologists don't do X, Y, and Z, and he's laying out the things he's going to do in the movie.
So, right, X never marks the spot, and it does, in fact.
It lays out the spot. He's like, you don't go on adventures. You don't do this. And he does all those things. It's the third time he's done it. No, there's, and I noticed that this in the comments as well. And I kind of want to broach it. They were talking about in TV, but there is this, there was this thing to make the hyper-masculine seem immediately negative. And I don't want to definitely agree with that. Because Indiana Jones is a great example of that. It's, yes, he actually is hyper-masculine when he's out here doing his indie stuff with his whip, and he's going around, he's sexing all the women, got his shirt open, but it's also his masculinity was kind of, it was almost pragmatic. Like, he had to be that way. Like, the fight had to be had. He needed to turn up that version of his masculinity. But I think also in playing the character of the professor of Indiana Jones, it's another side. It's a side of him that he just is more forlorn for the action side, but it's also still, he's still an intellectual. He's still a professor. He had to go through the ranks to get to become a professor.
Right.
Yale and things like that. So it's not like it's all masculinity in terms of the hyper aggressive side is all there is to masculinity. And I don't want that to be what's taken away from this conversation. I think the media portrayals of masculinity leaned specifically on that for so long that it became the trend. It became the trope. It then became the trope that people were responding to. So they turned it on its head and made everybody that did act like the bad guy. And then you saw the media trend again, flip on its head and go, well, there's something to that. We need to turn that back up a bit. So that's how you get the ebbs and flows from 80s action movies where masculinity was the racist and lethal weapons, the Rambos, the Rockies, the Schwarzeneggers. Then you see that turn down a little bit, and you can literally see in the size of action heroes when you get to the mid to late 90s where they become a little bit more waifish, like Keanu Reeves, who's now in Speed in The Matrix, and they start to turn up the athleticism and the mind of martial arts. So that's why your action stars get smaller. And then you see them all start to get bigger and burlier again in the mid thousands with 300, with Sin City, with just when The Rock starts to become an action star, like when you start to see the reactions to the reactions compounding.
So let me ask a question. Sure. So let's look at Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade specifically. Okay. That we have some layers of things going on here. First of all, we have what is basically Indiana Jones trying to reconcile with his dad. And that's pretty interesting. And that feels like a pretty wholesome theme. But we also have this sort of passing of the torch that the guy who plays his dad, whose name is escaping me right now, Sean Connery, also played James Bond. 007. Yeah. So it's almost like it feels like it's a passing of the torch to the next generation of sort of action actors as well, to me anyway.
No, that's literally what it is. Let's take the archetype and biggest example of what male masculinity was specifically to action movies for the past several decades, James Bond, Sean Connery, and let's have him be the father to the new action star or the archetype of action for that time. Because keep in mind, he's not only Indiana Jones, he's Han Solo. So like he literally is a passing of the torch to the new father of action with Indiana Jones.
I don't know how much farther we want to go with Indiana Jones, but I think there's another subversion of masculinity that exists in a less noticeable, but I think even more shocking way, which is with the villains. Because remember, like when we're talking about the Third Reich, we're talking about a regime that had a very specific set of masculine ideals and emphasized toughness as part of it, and you know, the ability to outwit and outstrengthen,
embarrass the Nazis a little bit, that if they were so tough, surely they'd be able to take care of Indiana Jones and his decrepit father,
right,
and his college buddy or whatever it was.
If you see the imagery that is used by propagandists of the Third Reich depicting the new Aryan man, it's always like a very put together, very efficient, and very hard to defeat individual, right? But in Indiana Jones, they are silly. They're goons. You can beat them up with a clever, quick trick that you whip out real fast, right? And so the sort of Third Reich's version of masculinity is directly overthrown frequently in how the villains are used, because the movie rejects the premise overwhelmingly. All of the movies in which the Nazis feature, I should say both of them, because you know, that is how you get back at them. You show them that the image of the ideal man they perpetuate is fundamentally wrong by outdoing them at it, but also at showing how they simply fail at it in a number of ways, even if they aspire towards it. Including female Nazi villains also subverts the rule, considering You know, the Third Reich is also known for being forced women out of the workplace and other things like that.
Yeah, I think that the Nazis are just a really great choice for the reason that they're so easy to subvert because they aggrandized themselves so much that they just make a perfect villain for these scenarios. Direct Emergency, I was going to give you a chance. Did you want to speak on Indiana Jones or something else?
I was actually going to bring up another topic to deal with the same topic we're speaking of, but in a different set of media, if that's okay.
Yeah, go for it.
So I wanted to bring up the topic of maybe toxic masculinity in Disney movies. What do you guys think about that?
Ooh, can you give us a specific example to chew on a little bit?
I was thinking, you know, how maybe Gaston
comes to mind.
Yeah.
I feel like he's the first. I feel like in the more recent adaptations, I believe Gaston shoots the beast in the back. And I was really surprised at how angry that made me, that how dishonorable that was of Gaston.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it can go as far as the character that is played in the Disney parks as well, how he acts.
Well, and he has to stay within the confines of the law, of course.
But he still has this whole, you know, bravado and, you know, he stays within the character, but this shows how deep that it goes within that character.
Well, this is a perfect, what I was going to call this was the not a role model, and that we see some of these. I don't think Gaston is one of them. I think the Joker is, though, where the Joker, the guy from Breaking Bad, the guy from American Psycho and others, that they end up being sympathetic people, at least in memes and in some discussions, mm-hmm. where they're probably not intended to be. So I feel like you could call that toxic masculinity, but I feel like there's also a little bit more to it. Troy, do you know what I'm talking about, or am I just talking about memes here again?
No. I mean, you are, but you aren't. So
that's you.
I wanted to address the Gaston of it all first. So Gaston is very much a representation of toxic masculinity through a very modern lens. If you're looking at him as a character that's supposed to be when the story takes place, so like early 1900s in France, he actually is technically the ideal. Because keep in mind, the only person that doesn't like Gaston is Belle. But Belle's also kind of a unique character on her own because she's very much what would have been modern by 1991 standards. She's very much a modern woman out of time. She's like, I just want to keep to myself. I want to read. I can do for myself. Leave me alone. And Gaston's like, but I'm all this man over here. Don't you want a piece of this? So I am jokingly a Gaston defender because I'm team Gaston was technically right. Like, no, she is going into a haunted mansion where there's a monster. We should agree.
I love it.
But he's kind of a douchebag and people don't want to agree with douchebags. So it's like, that's what makes it funny for me.
The Beast did have some red flags and his own toxicity to deal with. But I don't know that bringing a mob of pitchforks and torches to his door was necessarily the right solution there.
Well, it's not the right solution if you know he's a boy trapped in a beast body. If he's just a beast that's taking people hostage, you're like, no.
He was just a loner in this huge mansion. Everybody was scared to even, you know, what he was going to do because he was so angry at his situation. He let that, you know, that anger affect everybody else and projected that onto everybody.
But Disney is filled with male characters like that.
Absolutely.
For a bunch of different reasons.
I feel like that's why Hamilton fits so well. Like, they obviously, Hamilton was its own thing, but the Disney Plus hosts the movie and has those rights to it. But I feel like Hamilton is a really great example of, like, he's a tragic hero. It's basically a different version of Macbeth. In a lot of ways, that man who reached too high and fell down, like, oh, but look, he, you know, established a legacy. I'm like, yeah, a legacy of slavery. and I feel like the play mentions that here and there, but doesn't really sink its teeth into the fact that this guy walked away with, he's like, I built financial systems. I'm like, yeah, that were built on slavery. and that, you know, it's a little too easy to forget that. They do call him out at the final curtain. I think his wife says, quote, you could have done so much more if you only had time. I think he should have started earlier. I wrote a paper on this. I'm sorry. I'm preaching my thesis. I should stop.
I love it.
I think. Sorry.
Yeah, Jacob. Yeah, I've been talking to you.
I was going to say that Disney also has a habit in the last couple decades of subverting the strongman very hard. And this is going to be a weird take or weird direction to take this. But I think Wally is a major example of this because in a lot of stories you have the like female protagonist who looks to the male character and this is like the classic Disney formula. The female protagonist looks at the male character and wants to impress him because you know he's strong and she's beautiful, and that's like the concept. In Wall-E, you have they're not really male or female, they're robots, but you have a male-coded robot who is impressed by the strength and beauty of a female-coded robot and spends basically the whole movie failing at traditional masculine roles, but that not mattering in the end because Eva, the other robot, is it Eve or Eva? I'm not sure because Wally says it one way, but I'm not sure if he's pronouncing it correctly.
I always thought it was Eva, but I'm no Wally expert.
You know, you have essentially this subverted dynamic, right?
Well, there's
Wally
also
is the princess in this story.
There's an issue with masculinity and recycling and being environmentally conscious, which is basically what Wally does, right? So there's sort of a subversion there, although I've never understood why certain things get coded as non-masculine.
So you feel like Wally was, you know, Wally was obviously a male robot, and then Eve or Eva was the female, but give me, I'm trying to understand the take of Wally, kind of this masculinity, like in a negative way.
It's not that it's portrayed negative. There's nothing derogatory towards Wally as a robot in mm-hmm. the movie script, but he is contrary to a lot of like traditional male or male coded protagonist. I have to say male coded because it feels weird calling the robot male, but you know, he is afraid of everything. He's weak in comparison. He is sort of behind the curve. He is
psychologically inferior right. to her. It's a reach, buddy. You're reaching.
In every traditional masculine way, he is behind. And the movie does not resolve by him getting ahead in this regard. It resolves basically through him interacting with other characters, especially Eva, and just genuinely being caring, right? Mm-hmm. And so Wally presents an alternative masculinity within a Disney story formula that flips it on its head.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. So you're saying, like, so, like, in a way, like, the female robot, what, like, they portrayed him sort of the opposite of how they typically portray most of the formula, as you say, in the Disney movies.
Well, I think the fact that they're robots gives them an opportunity to sort of play around with archetypes in a way that is inherently subversive, because like we said, it's even a little weird to call them male or female, because like they are robots, so
how do we even verify that besides the name? And
I'm unwilling to verify that. I have no interest in verifying that.
There's also just the way that characters are designed in 3D animation traditionally, where like males are more boxy and females are more rounded. And you know, they appeal to this visual aesthetic. You also hear the sound of their voice, and it's like slightly coded that way, but also the default for most people when looking at an androgynous inhuman character is to say that it's, you know, male. And so Wally is introduced first and then given a female coded companion. So psychologically and culturally, we're going to assume Wally is male from the get-go and assume that Eve, who is slightly more gender coded, probably is female.
We should have just titled this one Misgendering Molly and left it at that. So I want to take a step back a little bit and ask about these sort of you know, characters that have high vicarity but are bad role models. And I'll just throw out an example. I think Scott Pilgrim is one. And I know I have a friend who like seemed to kind of look up to Scott Pilgrim but not realize. Stop me if I'm wrong here, but Scott Pilgrim is kind of a deadbeat. He's got no job. He's not going to school. He dated a high school girl. That's highly suspect. So, you know, is this something that's new, or is this something that's always kind of been going on?
I think it's kind of been going on. One that actually, when you mentioned that, kind of comes to mind is the character Sebastian in Cruel Intentions.
I don't know this one.
You don't.
Neither do I, admittedly.
Good one.
Really?
Wait, I have. Oh, I actually gosh. No. I have seen this, but I don't remember the specific character names. Okay. I watched this
Sebastian
years ago.
Sebastian was the, what's her name? Reese Witherspoon was the young, little, naive virgin as they portrayed her, and Sebastian was Ryan, was it
Ryan Philippe?
What was it?
Ryan Philippe or Philippe.
Yes. And he actually ended up marrying her later on. But and they had kids. But yeah, he was the he was one of the main characters along with
Michelle Geller.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I'm so terrible. I'd like to see
this is why we have Caster Troy with us.
he's on it, man. He's on it. But yeah, he very much. It was one of those movies of like, I guess it came out in 2000s. Help me out on this one.
I think it was in the 99 year, with that crazy year we got a bunch of dope movies. But I think Cruel Intentions.
Oh, we had a lot of good movies in that time. But you said it was like 1999?
99.
Okay, yeah. So he was just this character that, oh man, he was very attractive. It was like a teen drama kind of deal. But it really wasn't a teen drama because it had dealt with very adult, like you know, issues. But he was very, very toxic during the movie, yet a lot of people end up kind of flipping the script on with him, and in the beginning just having this huge disdain for him for what he was doing and trying to manipulate you know who I'm talking about, the blonde.
Reese Witherspoon, the senior girl.
Yes, Reese, yes. He was trying to manipulate her, and he was trying to push her into giving up like her virginity to him, and it was all a game to him. It was like a bet that he made with...
This was a racy movie.
It was very, very racy. It was a bet he made with his stepsister, who they had sexual relations amongst themselves, but she, Sarah Michelle Gellar, would use herself kind of like this little, she'd dangle herself like a little toy in front of him, and they were
carrot on a stick.
Yes, absolutely. And so she decided, they both decided they were going to take advantage of this girl who came in, who was just this innocence, this pure innocence to them. and they were both very just corrupted and played, they love playing games. So the game was that she would, you know, get with him if he was able to buy a specific time, you know, play into this, he was this good guy, and get her to sleep with him. And ultimately it ended up being where he fell for her truly, and the game, you know, wasn't but she found out about the game, so then of course she's hurt because she does end up sleeping with him. And then she finds out about all everything that happened, and he wants out of it. And in the end, anyway, he is kind of portrayed as this victim because he has changed in his ways of thinking, and he gets killed. And yeah, it's pretty much left with a lot of audience viewers feeling for this this main really terrible character.
It's the risk of doing the redemptive arc. And I'm glad you brought up Sebastian, because Cruel Intentions, I do really enjoy that movie.
It was a good movie.
But also comparatively to Scott Pilgrim, you have two characters who are your legit protagonists of the movie. This is who we're following. This is who our worldview is going to be through. But we're also seeing other people react to them. They're also very much redemptive arc stories. Like our friend who super looked up to Scott Pilgrim didn't realize that Scott Pilgrim is technically the bad guy of his own story the entire time, until the end where he physically learns the lessons and pulls the swords out of his own chest. Sebastian's the same way, but they also have things that people will absolutely lock onto as cool or positive traits. Scott Pilgrim makes good music. He has a good friend group around him. Sebastian is rich, got a dope car, has women that want him, is a good looking guy. But so as you're latching onto those things as a audience viewer, you're like, all right, but he kind of sucks. And then once they get the change at the end, like, oh, no, they're redeemed. So all the stuff that I latched onto at the beginning of this, still valid. But that's what ends up happening, is people don't take away the lesson from the movie. And you get the same thing from people that think, like, oh, I want to be just like Scarface, or I want to be just like the characters from Goodfellas. I want to be just like these other characters that are shown to be going through a terrible time, but they've latched onto the positives of that terrible time and lose the lesson on the back end. And to go to your question, Brocken, of how are they bad role models that people are taking cues from, it's not that they're bad role models. They are good role models for the stories they're supposed to be telling. It's that people are very selective in the lessons they want to take from those things. It's how you end up with a character like Patrick Bateman from American Psycho as a hero figure to certain people, even though he's legitimately a psychopath who harms people. It's the same way you get people that are like, I want to be like Scott Pilgrim, even though he's a douchebag who alienates his friends and date high schoolers while he's well into his 20s. Like, that's how you get, they miss the little things in the middle, and they don't say, I want to be the redeemed Scott Pilgrim, because to him, to them, that's all one thing. We're including the redemption in that, even if they're not actively excluding the things that made them bad to get to those redemptive points.
Yeah, it's like a lot of people that makes sense. Forget, they kind of want to forget about all the you know, the effed up things that they've done before, and because they've had this whole change of a character arc, they latch on to that, and all is forgiven.
Well, we are coming up to the end of our time, but I want to give everyone an opportunity to either share their final thought or maybe plug a project if you have one. Direct Emergency, thanks for joining us. Do you have anything you want to plug?
Y'all are way ahead of me in this type of conversation, and I truly enjoyed listening to everyone's views. Y'all are on it, man. I love it.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Well, I guess if I would just were to share a final thought, one on masculinity, just one on masculinity media. Actually, this kind of goes together. Masculinity in and of itself is not harmful. It is not toxic on its own. That is something that we have come up with to understand how it has been used, and how it has been used specifically against people. Masculinity can be an internal thing. Like, we've been talking about civic duty, family duty, like those things. But through the masculine lens, like, how do I, as a man and protector, however you want to label yourself, how do I carry out these things? The problem with the shorthand of media is that has not always been a fully thought out or fully shown thing. It's always been very segmented. You are masculine because you are strong and can fight. You are masculine because you are big and burly. You're masculine because you wear a suit, et cetera, et cetera. it's all those things and none of those things. And so I think in media, we are starting to slowly but surely get better. Like I said, as we're getting this deluge of Gen X and older millennial men realizing, oh, being a dad's kind of hard because it's hard to be all these things at once. And now you're getting The Mandalorian and The Logans and The Last of Us's. We're going to keep getting those stories as men figure out what masculinity means to them, but also how they want to share that and how they want to leave that legacy. And I think we have literally hundreds of years of showing how we got to this point, but also this is not an ending point. We're probably still firmly in the middle of showing what fully fleshed out masculinity looks like. But I don't want anyone to get lost in the sauce and thinking masculinity is bad. It's not. Like, it can be, like any tool, if used improperly, it can harm. So I just want that to be kind of like my last thing. It's like we're still figuring this thing out and we're watching media react to it. And it's going to be really interesting how this continues to go forward.
Yeah. Masculinity, I've always thought, is what you make of it. And in my view, it's probably best not to be enforcing your own style of masculinity on anyone but you. Jacob, do you want to throw out any final thoughts here as I get ready to read our show notes?
I was going to say we have a hand, but from Suderim, if you want to invite, I know her. She's in fact my girlfriend. If you want to invite her on the stage, she wants to share some thoughts, it looks like.
Hello there.
Hi. So sorry to pop in sort of like very last minute here, but I just was actually texting Jacob about something a few minutes ago, and I wanted to give an interesting example of what I thought was like a case where toxic masculinity is perpetuated by, you know, people who are not toxically masculine and actually quite the opposite. And it's going to sound maybe a little like controversial at first, but it's something I see a lot. And I think it just vaguely bothers me. So I want to know like other people's opinions. But it's the situation where you have two male characters in any kind of media, you know, movie, book, show, whatever, and like the moment that they show any kind of like amicable affection, there's kind of this movement to say, oh no, these are gay coded characters and they must be written like that. And I think, well, let's first of all like acknowledge the fact that if that's representation, that's scraping the bottom of the barrel, then like we need to reach much further, like if we want actual gay representation. But also I think it just kind of undermines the fact that like men can't have close amicable relationships. And I think those models are just like really, really important in media. And it's just a touchy subject because, you know, either way you look at it, you're either kind of negating a community that is historically very underrepresented, or you're saying that, you know, men can't be affectionate and remain friends. And so
this reminds me of Stargate in the early 2000s. I think this is a really interesting point. So I mentioned Stargate, you know, demonstrates a sort of military model versus an academic model of masculinity. But there are a lot of people in the gay community who really liked Stargate, and they really liked to put together videos that basically, you know, it was called shipping. And I think that's still a popular thing. And it is not a replacement for representation, which was not present. That like none of those... I believe all three of the main human characters were heterosexual. In fact, I believe they all were. But this was a way that the gay community can interact with what was still straight media and say, well, what if? And what if we looked at it this way? And what if I edit these scenes together? Like I said, it's not a replacement for representation, but I think it is an interesting and valid way for a fandom to interact with their media and sort of take it to a place the creators weren't taking it.
I'd also like to point out that this sort of revulsion to close male characters is in many ways a modern thing of our culture and definitely not like a historical theme. To point to two easy examples, we have like Gilgamesh and Enkidu, and then Achilles and Patroclus. Both show that like
Judas kissed Jesus.
Literary figures in history can be like close male characters, and this revulsion is in many ways, I think, towards like close male characters has a lot to do with the worries of our time more than anything intrinsic about the nature of masculinity.
Oh, like I was saying before, the reactions to the reactions to the reactions. I agree. Like in media, it's hard to see that. I do love, truly love that there's been a push in real life outside of media to let men just be like, no, dude, be affectionate. Tell your friends. Brocklin, you've known me for, wow, we've known each other for a long time now. Like 15, 16.
Yeah, it's been a while.
But you know, I've always been a hugger. I hug my friends, my guy friends, my girlfriends. Like I give hugs. I tell my guy friends, hey, I love you. Look, hope to see you again. Because that type of affection was starting to rescind. People weren't doing that as a reaction to the reaction. Like, well, we can't be too affectionate with our guy friends. People think we're gay. I'm like, oh, dude, one, so. But two, nah, man, hug your friend. That's just supposed to be your brother, your best friend. What the hell? So I'm hoping that we do start to see a reversion back to showing male affection in a like platonic way, because that is just life. You do that. So yeah.
I'll say that's probably easier when people have known each other for years and have been, you know, roommates and been through some experiences together. I like to think that, you know, on the long-term friendship, that's getting more common, but of course I don't know. What were you going to say, Jacob?
I was going to say that to link this around to a connection to our Christian memes. There is a lot of content online that reads the story of David and Jonathan as like a young love interest. And I think that really speaks to the fact that like there's nothing actually in the text that signifies that at all. They are framed by the text, presumably as close friends. But like our way of reading male affection is so tied with the idea that male affection is either gay or suppressed, that like a lot of people reading about the story of David and Jonathan can't help but ship them as a couple, because, you know, that's the state of our culture, right?
Yeah, I've definitely heard this.
Yeah, I wanted to just like also circle back for a moment and clarify something. I don't think there's a new thing necessarily wrong with like the shipping culture. It's imaginative, and that's really what, you know, literature is for, is to interpret that to, you know, to how you see fit in your life. But like when you assume that this is the artist's or the author's intent, I think that's where the problem gets, where the problem is for me, is you can't assume, first of all, you can never assume author intent. And second of all, it's like, how do I want to word this? Again, yeah, it's to say that, no, you know, these characters are like this. This is the representation that I have, and I'm fine with it. And I just think that's just a little bit sad. And we should push for something with a little bit more impact as far as, you know, queer representation, and then just acknowledge the fact that, you know, no, first of all, no one absolutely has any authority over characters and the way that they interact, and to accept that, you know, affection between male characters can just be exactly what it looks like. So that's my thought. Yeah, it's not to say that shipping shouldn't exist. It's just when you try to
shipping isn't solving any problems. It's fun.
Yeah.
And I like it. And I think it can be really funny seeing how people react to it. But it's not the same thing as representation. Not even close.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And yeah, I think shipping for many people fills some of that void, which fine, if that's, you know, if that's what you want and it helps in the moment, then sure. But I just don't think it's like the solution to the lack of queer characters and representation. So.
Well, thank you very much, Sufedrim, for taking us a level a little deeper here before you didn't let us get off the hook. So thanks for popping in at the end here. I am going to read our show notes unless anyone has anything dire. I don't want to cut anyone off here. All right, I'm gonna carry on because I see that everyone's on mute. That's my cue. This has been the Dank Christian Memes podcast. Our Dank Christian Memes is a place for all kinds of Christians and all kinds of non-Christians to enjoy memes and fellowship. If you'd like to connect with our community further, we have social media links in our description. Our music is provided by Olive Tiger. Thank you for listening, and until next time, may the memes bless you and keep you.